and unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, good morning. We're figuring this out as we go. Good morning.
Morning.
So welcome to the first time where we actually have an assembly, and I'm sitting in my usual spot, and we're just, it's a great problem to have, but we're having to figure it out all over again, or to try to remember, how did we do that? Because it's been, what, almost a year and a half.
Yeah.
So, what's a bodhisattva to do? So, Elena and John, is your son here today or no?
He is, but he decided that he just needed to chill on his own and enjoy being back home. So it's just John and I right now.
That's fine. It just has to be how much I have. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't catch what you said that last.
I said, that's fine. It only has to do with how much I explain.
Yeah, no, we're all good. It's the usual bunch.
So I want to talk from or about some our ancestor. He's not in our direct lineage, but he certainly is an ancestor, a Dharma, great, however many, uncle, Chaozhou. And he lived, they say, from 778 till 897, 120 years. Maybe. That's back in China. It's a little, you know, these things are part fact and part myth. But at any rate, he probably lived a long time. And he was known as somebody who would teach with words a lot and not be, he wasn't one of those yelling, hitting people kind of guys. And he was a great teacher. If you look at the collections of koans, of teaching stories, he's in there a lot. Sometimes the Japanese call him Joshu. But since he was Chinese, I like to use his Chinese name, which is Xiaozhou. But I wanted to start with a little bit of an introduction. I've been chewing on, not just in the study group, but in the Saturday lectures, with this notion of a bodhisattva. There's some really kind of, I started to say hard line. I guess I'll say hard line. Demanding descriptions of a bodhisattva. We call ourselves bodhisattvas. Sometimes we call ourselves bodhisattvas in training. Sometimes we call ourselves baby bodhisattvas. Sometimes we say we're small b bodhisattvas. And then there are the capital B bodhisattvas like Avalokiteshvara, who represents compassion and the one who hears the cries of the world. And Manjushri, who cuts through delusion and is often pictured with a sword, and we have one on the altar right behind me. And he's got a sword and it's the tip is red for Manjushri. And I've read that that's supposed to be a flame. But when you think of him cutting through delusion and he's got a sword with a red tip, I think of it as blood. And it feels like blood sometimes when you're working with letting go of something that is really hard to let go of. Or when there's something that you know you need to sit with, but part of you really doesn't want to. And it's a struggle to turn towards it and let go of distractions, including when your knee acts up and you know damn well your knee is actually just fine. But it's your body saying, let's not think about that right now. Let's not be with that fear. No, 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 no. Oh, my knee. Oh, my knee. The bodhisattvas on that level, but also the admonition to us is, as a bodhisattva, to not see difference, to just see suchness. Just see oneness. Maybe, probably you see difference, but you don't believe in it. But you can see it, but you don't make a distinction between the absolute and the relative. A bodhisattva lives in suchness. A bodhisattva lives in the lack of own being. But can you live there? I feel like I need to see distinctions. I need to see the meaning and context of words. I want to see my old friends. I want to hug them. I want to be hugged. I had lunch with an old friend in Sacramento on Thursday, and it was wonderful. I hadn't seen her in about a year and a half, probably. And she used to dog sit my former dog, so I introduced her to Rosie. But it was so great to see her in person. I've seen her on Zoom in various ways. So I think for me as a human being in this world, it's necessary to be able to talk and to choose words and to be with and touch other beings. And to grieve, and to have fellow feeling. I mean, I think a bodhisattva who lives in suchness has an awareness of others' feelings and responds. But it's hard to imagine, hard for me to imagine responding without some actual physical feeling of empathy, and I must admit, sometimes with projecting my experience onto it, right? I was upstairs during this last period of Zazen, and my neighbor, for whatever reason, was and continues to have a terrible time starting their car, and they just keep stepping on the gas, and it makes however you describe that noise, but it never catches, it never starts. And this has gone on now for the last at least 45 minutes, at least when I started noticing it. And it's painful to hear, you know, and you think you're just flooding it, which may be. But even when they wait a long time and then try again, I imagine it's to do with the spark plugs. I imagine they're not going to have much battery pretty soon. But it's painful to hear it. And I do project onto it. I had a partner who was out of work for a while and was really poor. And their car would overheat but they couldn't afford to get it fixed. So the way that you can drive a car like that all the way down Highway 5 in the summer from Seattle is you keep the heat on full blast. And it works. But it's pretty awful being in that car. And it feels pretty awful to know that you are subjecting other people to that, and there's really not much you could do about it. So that's what I project onto this neighbor. I really don't know why they keep trying, but my feeling response, and somewhat of a projection, but maybe accurate, is that they can't afford to deal with whatever the problem is. And I want to be able to feel that. And maybe a bodhisattva described as living in suchness could feel it, but I don't know about the projection part. And I'm not sure that the projection part is a bad thing. I mean, it's painful. It's painful for me to have that memory. It was very painful to drive all those hours with the heat blasting. But it's the pain of being human. It's the pain of being a part of whatever this is. And I mean a part. I mean, usually we say, you know, include yourself. When you say all beings, make sure that you include yourself. May all beings realize the Buddha way. May we, together with all beings, realize the Buddha way. May we together see Prajna, no Prajna Paramita, no the wisdom that goes beyond individuality, but at the same time sees all. I don't know if we need the empathy part, but we do need to make distinctions. We need to choose each word we say. We need to not walk into the table. We need to da 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 da. We need to eat. And I couldn't find the koan I was thinking of, and I've been referring to that, and I'm just sure it was Zhaozhou. It just must be Zhaozhou that he said he was in an exchange with a monk. He said that he didn't dwell in emptiness. Something like that. He didn't dwell in the place of enlightenment. And the monk said, "No, what? How can you not?" And he says, "If I did, you couldn't hear me." That's just got to be Jiajo.
Sounds like it.
Doesn't it? I'm sure. I think I didn't look far enough, and I didn't consult. I have people that I could write to, and they would get. They know. But I found another one, so I thought this is also really good. Some of the myth about him is that his lips emitted a golden light because he taught so much with his speech. An official asked Zhaozhou, "Will the master go into hell or not?" Zhaozhou said, "I entered hell long ago." The official said, "Why do you enter hell?" Zhaozhou said, "If I don't enter hell, who will teach you?" same point. Mm-hmm. If I don't enter hell, who will teach you? So that's right. We have to enter hell in order to relate to each other. And in some sense, to teach each other, we're always teaching each other whether we want to or not. You know, they say an enemy is a great jewel because you learn so much in coping. But at any rate, he was certainly an enlightened master, and he entered hell long ago. Buddha entered hell when he decided to teach. You know, after he was enlightened, the Buddha sort of, I'm going to say dithered. I don't know if Buddha dither, but he wondered for a while, you know, should I teach? It would just be such an irritation, and I don't think anybody would really understand me. So why put anybody through it, including myself? And Indra, Empress of the gods, came to him and said, please teach. There are those who will understand you. So he did. And he had to enter the relative world. He had to go, he had to talk to people. He had to go begging. He had to wash his feet. It doesn't necessarily feel like hell. It doesn't always feel like hell. It felt like hell listening to that car. And I know that some of it was my projection, and I put myself there. I could have put in earplugs. That somehow we have to find a way. Well, I don't know if we have to. Our practice is to find a way to navigate this, to be willing to be in hell, but without so much grasping after. And I want to now back up 1 second about Zhao Zhou. His teacher was Nanchuan. And so this is an illustration of a kind of sweetness, and also of Zhao Zhou's practice, that he was willing to really be devoted to a teacher. And I don't mean that in the sense of putting the person on a pedestal so much as laying down the ego burden of thinking you know, or laying down the ego burden of resistance and being unwilling to listen to somebody when they may be saying something you don't want to hear about. So on their first meeting, Nanchuan, who was lying down and resting, asked Zhao Zhou, where have you come from? Zhao Zhou said, I've come from Rujiang, omen figure. Nanchuan said, did you see the standing omen's figure? Zhao Zhou said, no. But I've seen a reclining Tathagata. Nanchuan got up and asked, as a novice monk, do you have a teacher or not? Zhao Zhou replied, I have a teacher. Nanchuan said, who is your teacher? Zhao Zhou stepped in front of Nanchuan, bowed, and said, in the freezing winter cold, a prostrate monk only asks for the master's blessings. Nanchuan approved Zhao Zhou's answer and permitted him to enter the monk's hall as his student. I only ask for the master's blessings. It's a wonderful way to say it. You know, so I'm not asking you to tell me the answers. I'm not asking you to order me around. I'm asking you to give me your blessing. I'm asking you to support my practice. Maybe I'm asking you to point at the moon, but I'm not asking you to give me the moon. And I'm going to read, I wasn't going to do this one, but it's such a great example that he, Xiaozhou, did not kiss Nanchuan's ass. That wasn't the idea. So Nanchuan said, people of this time must practice among different species. Xiaozhou said, not to speak of different, but what do you mean by species? Nanchuan got down on all fours. Xiaozhou shoved him over with his foot. And then Xiaozhou went into the Nirvana hall and yelled, sorry, sorry. Nanchuan instructed his attendant to ask Xiaozhou, what are you sorry about? Xiaozhou said, I'm sorry I didn't kick him again.
Wow.
So he was also, he was funny. And I think that he studied these, or this matter, a lot. Or maybe he felt that he had resolved it by, I don't know, agreeing to stay with us all in hell. But he was always showing this kind of letting go, or this. You know, we say that samsara, the world of suffering and confusion, and nirvana are the same. That it's how you relate to the samsaric world. Are you willing to accept it? Are you willing to at least allow the possibility that things as it is empty? Xiaozhou entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, it's like a lustrous pearl in your hand. If a foreigner comes, a foreigner reveals it. If a Chinese comes, a Chinese reveals it. This old monk uses a blade of grass as a 64-foot golden statue. I also use a 60-foot golden statue as a blade of grass. Buddha is affliction. Affliction is Buddha. A monk said, I don't understand whose house is afflicted with Buddha or by Buddha. Xiaozhou said, all people are afflicted by Buddha. The monk says, how can affliction be avoided? Why avoid it? Why avoid it? That's what we do too much, avoid it. A foreigner comes, a foreigner reveals it. A Chinese comes, a Chinese reveals it. I see it everywhere and everyone. It's like a lustrous pearl in your hand. You have a great gift. You have it. And I will add that your job is to uncover it. Your job is to polish it. This Prajnaparamita, the seeing clearly, that is a great gift. This wisdom that's gone beyond is a great gift. So whatever comes, whoever comes, they reveal it. And whatever comes, so that I use a blade of grass as a 60-foot golden statue. I also use a 60-foot golden statue as a blade of grass. No difference. A 60-foot golden statue is really is a reference to Buddha. Right? He was. There are 32 marks of a Buddha, and one of them is that he's 16 feet tall. So, but 60 will do. But that's the reference. That golden statue, this amazing statue, is a blade of grass. This blade of grass is an amazing statue. And Buddha is affliction, and affliction is Buddha. Huh? And it does feel like affliction sometimes. You know, when you're struggling to let go, when you're struggling to, I'm sorting through accept, know, practice with suchness, with emptiness, or with your afflictions, your hindrances, your unwholesome habits, your resistance, your greed, your lust, your denial. I'll stop. But in that struggle, that's liberation. You know, that's one of the things we say about Zazen, right? Zazen sometimes feels like you're just struggling, like you are afflicted with this popcorn machine mind, or with this greedy mind, or with this sleepy mind, whatever. And you just keep letting your hindrances go and coming back to your breath and your body, let it go, come back, let go, come back. That's Zazen. Noticing that you're afflicted, that's Zazen. That's practice. Floating off into Lotus La La Land. That's really nice, and you should have some of that. But the Zazen of affliction is the Zazen that we really learn from. It's that letting go of difficulties that we really learn from. And that's the Buddha is teaching us, and the affliction is teaching us. Why avoid it? Can you avoid it? No, I don't think you can avoid it. I mean, you can avoid it in the sense of denial, and it'll come back and bite you in the butt, or your loved ones, or both. How can it be avoided? Why avoid it? Why avoid it? So I think that'll do as an answer to this koan of how to be a bodhisattva. And in this world, why avoid it? Would you ask yourself when you can feel yourself avoiding whatever? Why avoid it? I'm going to stop. Why avoid it? So do you have any questions or comments? Steve?
I have actually so many comments and things to say that I'm going to have to try hard to keep it short. The essence of what comes up for me is that a lot of afflictions of mine seem to be like considering that as somebody who occasionally teaches the Dharma formally by giving lectures and tries to teach it all the time to myself and to myself and others, and often, you know, well, I'm a human being, fail a lot. I often feel like there's something that prevents me from really getting it, and that I'm kind of not the real thing. It's sort of like imposter syndrome, but it's more like just feeling like I should be a better example. And that tends to sit in me like really like a hard place inside in my stomach. And I can, when I say that's okay and let go of it a little bit, then it comes right back. It's constant effort. So my response is to say, yeah, I guess, I don't know if I'd say that's hell, but it is a small personal hell. And it feels just a little bit better to not worry about it so much, to say it's okay to share this kind of thing like I'm doing now, with kind of the hope that it'll help a little bit too and help other people who may have similar issues. Anyway, I think that is encouraging to just not try to avoid it. There, I hope that was short enough.
Getting to know you. Kate?
I first wanted to say that I had so much joy this morning seeing you all in the Zendo together. And Mary, you had this big smile on your face as everybody was chanting together. And it felt good to hear your voices together. Usually in Zoom, all I ever hear is my own voice. And so, or the bell. So it was really, I don't know what the word is, but it felt wonderful to see you together, and to hear the bells and to hear you chant together was, it was a great first effort. So I look forward to us continuing in this way. And as far as the content of the lecture, I feel always like the instruction is somehow you have to do both. You have to, or I have to make the effort to suffer with and at the same time not be attached to it, which is when I'm suffering with, I most often want to figure out a way for everyone not to suffer. And that doesn't usually work in my experience. I really enjoyed the stories, and I think that's it. Thanks.
Kelly?
I was thinking about the idea of being in hell or choosing to be in hell. and kind of rolling it around in my head. And I was like, do you make that choice, or are you already there and you're just acknowledging it? that was my question. And it led me, Heather is reading Huckleberry Finn for the first time. Uh-huh. And it's a difficult book. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about it, but I think it's fascinating because there is literally a point where when Huck decides that he's not going to turn Jim in, he's going to let him go. He says, I'm going to go to hell for this. Mm-hmm. I am damned, because that's what he's been taught. And he says, but I'm still going to do it. I'm going to let him go. And I know that I'm damned forever. And he ends up being liberated by that. And that just kind of stuck in my head, thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and it's difficult. Because when you said that it was difficult, I thought, what? And then, oh, right, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult. It's challenging.
Yeah, it ain't Tom Sawyer.
No. In fact, Tom Sawyer shows up and he's a villain.
That I forgot. At any rate, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe for us anyway, it's we are there. Whether Jiaozhou would have been, probably, but at any rate, we're there, and we make that samsara nirvana by our attitude and relationship with that samsara. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and maybe we don't choose it exactly, but we can work with accepting it and work with letting it teach us, letting it afflict us. Why avoid it? I think that's going to be my mantra for a while.
Yeah. Accept the affliction.
Yeah. Anybody else? Zach? And then John?
I definitely get suffering. And I get samsara doing the same dumb stuff over and over again. But I have a problem with hell. And maybe it's not being an appreciator of, what do we call that? Judeo-Christian religions. When I think of hell, I think of that. And I guess I should just let go of that and that concept. But I think one thing that I've learned over the years of practice, that trying to avoid bad stuff doesn't work. And kind of looking at it is painful, but it over time it helps, I think. And so maybe that's a way of living with suffering, but maybe not with samsara, is to look at it and, what do we say, let it arise, abide, and die.
And speaking of hell, as Mel used to say, don't get caught by the words.
For sure.
John?
Thank you for the talk and presenting that to us today. I noticed that when I am in avoidance, as you're describing, it seems to create even more suffering. And sometimes it creates so much suffering, I don't understand how I'm creating it because I'm avoiding it. And then I tend to blame everyone or everything else around me and take responsibility for nothing. And I think that that's what I got out of that, is being willing to sit with it and just, I don't know if it's the right word, but take responsibility for where I am, who I am, how I got here, even if I don't fully understand it. Here I am, and I'm suffering. And like any other human, I got a lot of opinions about that. And being able to see how they are, how these things arise when I'm sitting, has been beneficial, because when I sit, I can also be greedy for wanting that peace, that relief, and this and that. And well, when I sit and I see all the busyness, I see what I'm attached to and probably what I need to work on and what's going on in the back of my mind. And sometimes it comes out from deep places, like, wow, where the heck did all that come from? Because it may not even be things I'm thinking about every day, but clearly I was attached to it because it came up. And, being able to see that come out of the emptiness or wherever the heck it's coming from is and it sheds a lot of light on things. So it seems like the more that I sit, the more I realize how much I have attached to stuff. And I try to just be okay that I'm not okay with that. Because day by day, it's like, okay, well, then maybe I just need to not make my life harder than it needs to be in the people around me and the relationships that I have through my suffering. Because you owe me, because I'm suffering. and that's, it's just not nice. It's just not a nice way to be. And I think earlier part of my life, I took on more of an attitude like that than I would like to admit. Until I started some sort of practice, being able to see, being able to sit with those characteristics of that suffering. And it's like, okay, how come it's hard for me to form relationships with other human beings? Well, maybe it's because I get greedy about certain things. And so being able to just try something different, and maybe there's an ability to see where I'm suffering, but then being able to reach out to people to form other relationships rather than thinking I know it all. Because I don't. And anyway, I think I might just end up blathering if I go on from here. So I'll be done. Thank you.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow.